happen, we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this week's Gay USA. I am alone at the moment because Andy is off for a few weeks vacation, but I'm going to bring you a very, very special show this week. We are celebrating the 30th anniversary of the creation of the wonderful television program Dyke TV. And I have two very special guests, two of the co-creators of the show, Linda Chapman and Mary Paterno, who are joining me here. We're going to show you a ton of video from Dyke TV, which I'm showing to you because I suspect most of you haven't seen it. It lasted for 12 years. It was groundbreaking. It is heartbreaking, thought-provoking, hilarious, and you're going to love every minute of this. So let's bring on Linda and Mary and get started. There we go.
Hello.
Hi. My old colleagues, I did some Dyke TV. I'm going to spare you that this week because, you know, I can't watch it. My contributions. In the white T-shirt there, Linda Chapman, co-creator of Dyke TV, longtime producer at the New York Theater Workshop. And in the plaid shirt, Mary Paterno, co-creator of Dyke TV and a longtime independent film and video producer. So we're going to have very little time to talk because we want to show a lot of Dyke TV. In fact, let's look at the opening credits.
Hi, I'm Mary Edwards.
And I'm Laurie Weeks.
And you're watching Dyke TV.
Television to incite,
subvert,
organize,
and provoke.
And that it did. So, Linda, how did this get started and why?
Anna Simo, who I had been working with as a director, a theater director, Anna as a playwright, had created a small not-for-profit to be able to raise funds for our work. And Anna called me, said, I've joined the Lesbian Avengers, and we need an outlet for our activist news. And she called Mary and I to a meeting. Manhattan Neighborhood Network was soliciting for new programming, and Anna thought this would be a vehicle. So here we are. I mean, Mary, how did you meet Anna?
Oh, I just knew Anna from the neighborhood. We'd lived in the Lower East Side together, and I was very much involved with WOW, and right. Which is a women's theater on East 4th Street. And so I just knew her from the neighborhood. And I just wanted to add this. She said she wanted Dyke TV to be the propaganda wing of the Lesbian Avengers.
That's right. Oh, I have to say this too. Sorry to take too much time, but the other part of it is that she didn't want the Lesbian Avengers to control the news output. So she wanted it to be the propaganda wing, but she didn't want them to be in control.
It was the 90s. You had to be there. Well, let's start with, in fact, a couple of very newsy segments. Then we'll go to absolute frivolity. But these segments are eerily prescient for what we're going through now, but they aired 30 years ago.
Next, an eyewitness, a look at the recent attacks on women's health care clinics.
Pro-life is a lie. You don't care if women die. Pro-life. I'm here because I'm incensed about the killings of people at abortion clinics, which I see as a part of this really frightening radical right movement around the country right now, which to me, as a lesbian and as a woman, includes these attacks on a woman's right to have an abortion, this violence in the name of religion, as well as anti-gay initiatives springing up around the country, which to me also implicates the rights of all minorities. And it's part of this radical right movement trying to enforce sort of a male hegemony and take away the autonomy of women, of people of color, of lesbians and gays.
The range of violence and harassment that exists at the clinics is kind of incredible. It goes from the two people on a Saturday doing their quote-unquote sidewalk counseling and simply yelling at women not to kill their babies as they go into the clinic. And then that can be escalated to the blockades where they physically try to stop women from going into the clinics at all.
We have seen a shift. Generally, what used to happen was a large-scale blockade where you'd have hundreds of people come out and essentially block the doors so nobody could get inside. And then when that became a little less feasible for a variety of reasons, there were more so-called Minuteman attacks where a small number of antis would squirt superglue into the lock of the doors or would kryptonite the doors closed or would kryptonite themselves to the doors, would damage equipment, would destroy patient records.
There are arsons and firebombings of clinics all the time, and they don't even hardly get in the papers anymore.
It's sort of seen as, well, there's the reasonable anti-choice movement, then there's the violent anti-choice movement, when in reality, the rhetoric makes people like this feel justified in the name of religion, and it's creating an extremely dangerous situation.
The rhetoric that they all use of calling us murderers and calling abortion murder is what incites the fanatics who are shooting doctors, the fanatics who are blockading clinics, to do what they're doing. And until they change their rhetoric, this is going to keep happening.
The people who have sowed the seeds of violence is Margaret Sanger and Planned Parenthood by killing 4,400 children every day. The people that have sowed the seeds of violence are the federal government, who has crushed a peaceful movement like Operation Rescue. We have acted in a responsible, reasonable manner, and we've been crushed. So if you want to look for the seeds of violence in America at abortion clinics, look at the abortion providers and look at the federal government. Don't look at peaceful demonstrators.
The worldview of people who are spending significant portions of their life and energy opposing abortion, opposing gay rights, is this worldview that sex outside of marriage, sex not designed to produce children, is evil and is causing all of the problems in the world, from street crime to pollution to what they see as the dissolution of American society.
While inciting hatred on talk show radio is not the same as stockpiling munitions, the connections between one paranoid mentality and another are not so difficult to discern. While the dust settles in Oklahoma City, one wonders about the anti-government sentiment that swept the Republicans into Congress and the armed anti-government sentiment that could be responsible for the destruction of the federal building. To those who have been covering the moves of the radical right recently, the blast came as no surprise. Dyke TV spoke with photojournalist Donna Binder.
When I heard about the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, you know, my first thought was that it was them, it was the militia. For the past several months, I've been concentrating very much on the right wing and the different right wing movements in the U.S. Everything from sort of the what is a little bit more out there, like these sort of militia folks, to Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole and some of the Republican campaigns. I think there's a movement in this country that isn't always talked about or given credence to in the press that's very serious. I think the biggest alarming thing for me came when I went to Dallas, Texas, to photograph what was a militia and survivalist sort of kind of a meeting convention extravaganza. It really struck me when I was there just how... certainly if you do any research, how large the movement is. It's a network across many states. And the thing that really is the most, eye-opening thing about it is that, you know, they're not just another right-wing movement in a lot of ways, like, you know, we can talk about the anti-abortion people, although certainly they have used bombs, but all of these people are armed. I mean, their whole thing it focuses on armaments, focuses on guns, military-style trainings, you know, bomb-making workshops. These people have, like, carloads full of, like, you know, assault rifles, night vision goggles. I mean, what are they preparing for?
Jeez. It's chilling. And this was 30 years ago, and they haven't lost a step. And now they have the Supreme Court on their side and half the state's governors and legislatures. So how did you get so smart to produce this 30 years ago?
I mean, I think we were all activists and very much involved with many different movements. I mean, obviously, we were very involved in the lesbian and gay movement, but all of us had history in, anti-racist movements, anti-military movements. So I think we just had our ear to the ground, like what was going on. Donna Binder is a colleague of ours and a friend. So we knew the work that she was doing following the militias and the radical right. So she was somebody that we definitely wanted to talk to after the explosion in Oklahoma City.
And Karen Moulding was a very active ACT UP member who I enjoyed seeing in that clip. But yes, a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Linda?
Well, I was just going to say Mary was involved with ACT UP as well. You worked with ACT UP, and I think a lot of connections. I think the Lesbian Avengers actually grew out of some of the women in ACT UP who felt like we should be dealing with our own issues here. We've gone a long way for, you know, the men's community, but women have AIDS too, you know, and we have breast cancer, and we have a lot of issues. We're still not equal, seen equal in the queer community or anywhere else. So, I think that there was a huge outreach when we started to the activist community, but particularly to people who were working in media, and a lot of ideas came to us from individuals. We really wanted to honor, you know, those individual points of view
and the urgency of the times.
Yes.
This
absolutely
was unavoidable material. And I'm so grateful that Dyke TV was out there doing this and informing people. I wish more people had paid attention and we'd made some progress against this. But this is invaluable documentation of what was going on. And maybe we can learn some lessons about longevity and their relentless dedication to
Relentless pursuit of destroying democracy.
Violently.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now we're going to take a 180-degree turn. Put on your seatbelts. This will be a more comic part of Dyke TV.
Hi, Laurie Eastside, Dyke in your face. So do you find yourself at home reading the Daily News and Post, finding articles titled Trendsetter that talk about how it's a new trend-setting thing for Hollywood celebrities to go to lesbian clubs? How trend-setting? Well, did you happen to find anywhere in any newspaper the news about Madonna going to the Clit Club to audition out butch lesbians for her new show? Of course not. That's real news. Yes, Madonna did go to the Clit Club, first calling to make sure it was okay. She showed up around midnight. She was wearing, which I know what you want to know, she was wearing shorts, Dyke boots, a black bra, a sleeveless t-shirt, and her braid extensions a la Dita. And she came armed with a blow pop, lollipop, for Julie Tolentino, the proprietist and manager of the Clit Club. When I asked Julie why the blow pop, all she did was giggle and tell me it went back to a private moment they shared while photographing the sex book. Anyway, Madonna went in, paid her $5, had a little beautiful lesbian escort, a woman from L.A. nicknamed Chicken. Now, you might think that's a lesbian nickname, but Chicken was so nicknamed Chicken from her South Central gang days. Yes, this is a real street lesbian who is now the fashion celebrity choice of the month, who we know and love, who is now seen on Madonna's arm everywhere, and sometimes not seen, but still with Madonna in those private moments, if you catch my drift. Anyway, Madonna hung out for quite a while. She drank water, she smoked no cigarettes, she talked to nobody. And my favorite two moments of the night was when someone went right up to Madonna and said, "You know, you look like Madonna. Did anyone ever tell you that?" Oops. Later, Madonna went out for some air because, as we all know, the Clit Club is, yes, small and warm, just like a clit. Yuck, yuck. She was outside hanging out with Chicken when a man came up to her, and she thought, oh no, here we go. And the guy said, "Look, I'm dying to get into that club, and you need a man needs a woman to get in. Would you escort me inside?" Where Madonna thought, oh my God, first the lesbians don't recognize me, now the men don't recognize me, I'm going home. Madonna then left. But follow-up story, Madonna has booked her new concert tour. All her backup dancers are out butch lesbian dancers. No matter what you think about this woman, I think we as a community should support her, because, hey, who else has given us the jobs? That's it for me. Now, I'll see you soon. Laurie Eastside, Dyke TV. Bye-bye.
Ago, I was out for my Sunday cycling routine. Everything was just perfect, as usual, when suddenly things went amiss. Well, my spirits were pretty deflated when this stranger appeared, thinking she was going to save the day. This girl is lucky, because I knew all about bikes. And you know the way girls are. They're just too shy to ask anyone for help. Maybe I did need her help, but I didn't exactly want a lesson.
Now in the future, what you're going to need is a pump and a patch kit. And when you go into that bike shop, you have to be confident because they're not going to take you seriously. Give me a patch kit and a pump! Come on, let's go! I don't have all day!
Unscrew the washer from the Presto valve. Get your patch kit, take out your tire irons to begin the tire removal process. Slip iron number one carefully under the lip of the tire, lifting it up and over the rim of the wheel and then anchoring it to one of the spokes. With iron number two, slip it under the tire and gently slide it around the rim, remove the first side of the tire. Pull out the inner tube, taking the Presto valve out last. Remove the tire from the wheel, ever so carefully run your finger around the inside of the tube, extracting any glass or debris. Pump up the tube to check for the location of the hole. With a piece of sandpaper, crosshatch a surface to prepare it for the patch. Apply the glue to the area, allowing it to dry for 5 minutes. Peel your patch of choice, place it over the hole, rub vigorously with your finger, and you're set. Now you're ready to put the tire on the wheel, only halfway. Pump up the tube, just a little, and put in the Presto valve in first. Insert the tube under the tire so it rests on the rim. Release the air from the tire. And finally, using only your hands, roll back the other side of the tire onto the rim of the wheel. Be sure that the line of the tire meets the wheel at the rim. Not below, not above, but at the rim. So when the tire was mended, she helped finish the job. And I realized that she was all right. Like a guardian angel, my very own Frankie Avalon. And I would never forget her. And me, well, you know how it goes.
picture was taken in East Lansing, Michigan in 1970. That's me at a couple of weeks old with my Sri Lankan mom and my white daddy. I like this picture because it shows a happy little interracial family before the big divorce several years later. That's me as a baby dyke on my big wheels. This picture was taken at my grandmother's house. I'm 4 years old. This picture was taken at Universal Studios. I'm 8 and I'm just beginning to explore S&M. I'm thinking, top, bottom, switch? When I was 18 years old, I was modeling in New York City. This picture was taken in 1989. In retrospect, I realized that one of the reasons I got into modeling was that I was trying to be what I thought it meant to be straight. I ended up quitting because I was told that I was too ethnic looking to model in this country. The funny thing is that I think that they made me look really white in this photo. I moved to San Francisco from Michigan in 1994 because I wanted to find a queer South Asian community. And this is taken this summer at the San Francisco Dyke March. I'm carrying the Tricon banner. Tricon is an organization for queer South Asians. I was really pumped up in this picture. It was because our contingent was the fiercest. We were really something.
I'm Sandy Bullman for Dyke TV. We're here in San Francisco at the Cow Palace for the Bay Area Regional Rodeo. Gay Rodeo started in Reno in 1976 as a fundraiser for muscular dystrophy. This rodeo is a fundraiser also for the Bridge for Kids. The Bridge for Kids is a respite care center for families with children who have AIDS. There are around 5,000 people here today, and prize money is more than $25,000.
The women in our rodeo are allowed to compete in all of the events. We have 13 different events. They range from rough stock, roping, horse events, and camp events. And the men and the women do not compete against each other, but we all compete in the same events. We use the same stock. We have the same rules. For me, it's kind of a way of life. I have been rodeoing for 26 years. When I was a senior in high school, they put girls steer riding into our high school circuit. And I rode steers my senior year, which got me hooked. And I did it kind of on a dare.
Actually, it's always been my fantasy to be a cowgirl myself, and here I am living my childhood fantasies.
Well, I'm chasing 70. Are you chasing skirts in here? Oh, I'm looking around. My eyesight hasn't gone yet anyway.
Plus, the butts are really cute here in their Wranglers.
Wranglers.
To be able to walk around and hold her hand in public and say, this is my lady, and we love each other, is a wonderful feeling, and someday, hopefully, we'll be able to do that everywhere.
What a collection of pieces. Yeah. Amazing, amazing. So, you know, you had such a rich load of material. Where'd you get all that?
Well, I think that one of the things that we really wanted to focus on was humor. I mean, and the Avengers did that too. If you look at like what they did for marketing, actually in ACT UP as well. I mean, the Avengers, their tagline was "We Recruit," which was sort of what was thrown at us as an insult that gays and lesbians recruited. And of course, now they're, what do they call it now? Grooming.
And they're still yelling about that. Someone at the drag march this year, yes, was chanting "We Recruit" as a joke, and now it's all over the right wing media as, yeah, something serious.
Yeah. So I don't know. I think that we, you know, I mean, we had a variety of producers on those segments, but we really, really wanted to use humor, and we did not only throughout the show, but I think in our marketing materials. Carrie Moyer, the artist, created just brilliant designs for us and the Avengers to promote the work that we were doing and the activist events that were happening. And we always had a healthy dose of humor. Where the idea came out that lesbians are humorless, I never got. because I just find last week's to be hilarious, honestly.
Exactly, exactly. And you had to mitigate the heaviness of the real subject matter, because it was, I mean, we didn't think at the time that we were going to lose the abortion rights 30 years ago. We thought that the right wing, for instance, was somewhat remote in terms of the militias. But we also, both Mary and I, related to the magazine format program, where you could have a wide variety of lesbians. You know, we're everywhere. That was something that was really important to us. So, you know, the sports, the arts, the
And I Was a Lesbian Child was an ongoing segment over the years. What was the thinking behind that?
That was just an opportunity for people to talk about, like, coming out stories, stories of their people's childhood. And you know, everyone had to either bring photos or home movies. And I think it allowed us to just show again the range of people and of the diversity of our community.
That's right.
And the tire fixing piece may be the single funniest thing I've seen in anywhere in 10 years. All right. Well, then it gets even a little more personal. We have another chunk of segments that we want to move to that deal with dating.
Hi, my name is Sid, and we're talking dates, right? Okay. A nice date would be a long ride in the sunshine, out of the city. Then we get back to the city, we can go to a show, you know, performance art or movies, and some dinner too. Let's see. There's a lot of places you can go on a bike. I hope you like to ride. So if you like this idea, you can write to me, Sid, at Dyke TV, Box 2. Thanks. Bye.
When I'm out cruising in a bar, my goal somewhat depends how horny I am.
My goal would be to meet my love. Phone number is good, a good start.
I'm looking for the U-Haul.
I usually, unfortunately, meet women through my friends.
I like to meet women in usually back rooms.
I meet them at the grocery store.
I'll prefer clubs. You know, I think clubs are designed for that purpose.
Basically, what I'm looking for in a woman is a kind of energy, a kind of erotic tension that I feel. I like butch girls.
I like more aggressive looking women.
I love Latin women, without a doubt. Latin and dark hair are my thing. It's very exciting to me to see a dark-haired woman. And a dark-haired woman with dimples, I'm a goner.
I'm kind of aggressive, you might say. And so I tend to just kind of walk over to them and start a conversation just about anything.
I usually get a friend to approach them for me.
Do you have a dollar?
Have you been looking for me?
Hey, you dropped something.
Because I've been looking for you.
And if you ask me about it, what, I would say, your smile.
For cruising, you mainly have to use your eyes. And for flirting, it's definitely an eye thing.
I feel it already. I'm right looking at it. Oh my God, I want you.
In terms of lesbian history, I would say that On Our Backs was spawned as a response to an anti-pornographic faction of the lesbian community. And On Our Backs, along with other publications, really felt a need to not kind of negate the body in that way, to say that the body has all these possibilities and our, you know, involvement in sexual practice is much wider than people are really ready to talk about. And I think historically, On Our Backs was a challenge. You know, that challenge still exists. And On Our Backs is kind of bold in the sense that it doesn't really make excuses for itself or its presence.
The history of these journals really lies in what's been called the sex wars.
It lies with the first writings about Butch Femme, which I did and others did, and the reaction, a negative reaction pretty much. They incurred deep anger. I mean, they were called pornographic. I remember going into women's bookstores all across this country where they would not be sold. There were stores, women's stores, that were closing rather than sell them. They would only be sold under the table. And so they became a focal point of this debate within our community, which is how can women write about sex without playing a role in the continued victimization of women? And what's happened is the debate has really shifted in some ways. And the response to these journals from being so judgmental and being shameful and treating them as if they were dirty, you know, I think now there's a wide community who reads them without shame.
I really appreciate all the different body types. I appreciate the different kinds of photography and the different kinds of lighting. And I also very much appreciate the fact that they really address safe sex.
I really can't say what's going to happen in 100 years. I just, for my own feeling, is that we're never going to go back to the erotic silences we once both accepted and used to protect ourselves.
Women need to know. It's time to wake up to the fact that HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, is hitting women hard. We have the power to protect ourselves and those we love. If you choose to have sex, be safe. Use protection every time. Don't go sharing needles. Get tested. Knowledge is power. We can't afford to lose any more sisters. You're hearing that straight from the Queen.
The internet. Is it driving us into isolation or bringing us closer together? Dyke TV decided to take a closer look into this matter.
Women are dating each other like crazy. There is incredible traffic of courtship that goes on the internet.
Well, I've been having this virtual relationship for about since November 7th with someone that I met in the Butch Femme room on AOL.
The good parts about being online was that you get to chat and just have a nice conversation. I don't know, what's the bad part?
I think one of the good parts is that you get to know the person more about the person that you're talking to, actually talk about their lives before you. It's not like just meeting a person and seeing them and deciding that you want to talk to them. You really know the person before you actually meet them. You know more about them.
It's unusual not to see someone and have that physical interaction, but just to have a sort of mental, emotional, spiritual connection.
Well, I think that the internet is a little elusive. I love my conversations, but the reality of meeting somebody and talking online leaves a lot to be discovered. That's all I can say.
I don't always wait for pictures as far as deciding who I'm going to date online. If I like the person enough, I'm talking to them. But then there are times that you like the person enough to talk to them and you get the picture and you change your mind. You know,
yeah,
not to sound shallow,
yeah.
Not to sound shallow, but that does happen.
Although,
sometimes people lie about appearances.
Exactly.
Hilarious.
And personal ads. You are running personal ads. Do not try to contact Sid. That post office box is no longer operative.
Yeah.
How in the world did you have the guts to run personal ads?
Well, how did we have the guts to do any of it, Ann? I feel we have gone backwards. We've gone backwards, and the internet probably has had a lot to do with it. Nobody's doing this kind of work anywhere. But it just seemed we didn't have any censors. We were on Manhattan Neighborhood Network. You know, Robin Bird can do what she does on.
Well, she's on the least access channel, not the public access channel, and is a wonderful human being. I love Robin.
No, I do too. But I'm just saying she kind of opened the way for. So we were just trying to. I also think it was a very liberated moment because we did not have the censors. I can't believe how far backwards we've gone, honestly.
It's true. Mary?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that we were just doing what people wanted to produce. We really left the production open to what was interested our producers. So they actually pulled together so much of the energy and material that we created. We would have production meetings once a week, and we try to call together people, and we reached out to lesbian organizations all throughout New York initially, but then all throughout the country to get ideas and to try to create as much programming with as much diversity in terms of topic, in terms of people as possible. And I think we were actually really successful. You have to remember that there wasn't a lesbian anywhere in the media back then. Ellen DeGeneres didn't even have her show yet. No. And then when she had her show, when she came out, she was fired. So we were really we were filling what we thought was a very, very deep void.
Now, Linda, you say we don't have this stuff anymore. I don't know about you, but I'm not trolling YouTube or TikTok looking for it. It may be there and we're too old to see it.
No, but, I don't think so. We watch YouTube because we find a lot of different interesting video on YouTube. And I would say the lesbian content is not as interesting and not as personal. It's again, I think we've kind of reverted back to the male gaze more in what's being presented or what's considered. That was a really special moment because we were right at the I don't know, at the beginning of something. I feel like that went away very quickly because there was more lesbian. I think we helped, you know, whether it was conscious or not. I think we did help people like Ellen. Remember some of the Vanity Fair with K.D. Lang being shaved.
Cindy Crawford.
Yes, exactly. That was that moment, you know, and I think we were in a way riding a crest. We were also, we knew each other. We were all meeting in person. We were together all the time. It wasn't something else. There was community in what we were doing. So it was a lot of different, just a lot of different perspective. And remember that sex shop that had just opened up, Mary? We did a feature. It was a women's focused sex shop. And that was
in Toyland. I think they're still there.
Yes.
I think they're still there.
That's right.
And this does raise the larger question about where the lesbian community is these days, because there are concerns that we're fading away as an identifiable group. And that's the heartbreaking part of this.
Yes.
All right. Well, you mentioned reaching out widely. You reached out, in fact, internationally. And our next chunk shows some segments from various locations outside the U.S.
あの世界的にあの、ゲイ男の人のゲイそれとゲイムーブメントがあってであのレズビアンもあのムーブメントがあるわけよね、アメリカとかヨーロッパでは。
In many Western countries, there's long been a gay movement and a lesbian movement, and there's been an influence of these on Japan. Also, within Japan, for the past 5 or 6 years, the gay men's movement has really been building up, and that's also influenced lesbians. The lesbian movement is much more active, and younger lesbians have started to use terms like lesbian rights.It's sort of a new development.
日本のフェミニストとレズビアンの関係ね、はい、あの日本のフェミニストのほとんどはレズビアンじゃなくて、
Most Japanese feminists are not lesbians. There are some lesbians who work with straight women, but for the most part, both groups work separately and conduct their activism separately.
女の人はそれだけの生活費を一人で稼ぐわけに。ことができなくて
In Japan, you need money to be involved in the women's movement. You don't have a lot of time. So if you're financially supported by a husband, you have a lot of time to do activist work. I don't know about the 70s women's movement, but the movement I'm involved in now, that's the state of things. I have started to meet more single women, but they're not lesbians. I don't know why they're not more lesbians. But the movement is booming right now. It's very active. On Sunday, we had the second lesbian and gay pride parade in Tokyo. Last year, there were 1,200 people. This year, there were more. It's very active, but somehow I think it's just a trendy thing. It's like a fashion. Whether this movement is going to progress to something that will actually secure rights for lesbians, I kind of have my doubts.
In the United States, it's not unusual for a lesbian to lose her children because of her sexuality. In The Next Eyewitness, we look at a case of discrimination in Argentina, where a transgendered woman lost custody of the children she was raising, not for lack of love and care, but because of her gender identity. Her story revisits the fundamental question, who makes a good mother?
No congeles el júbilo, no quieras con desgana.
Ser madre significa hacerse cargo de la cría. Madre es aquella que,
to be a mother means to take care of offspring. The mother is the one who prepares children politically, socially, and psychologically, who raises them the best way possible.
En lo mejor que puede.
Mariela Munoz always wanted to be a mother, and when just 20 years old, she began by unofficially adopting the first of 17 children. At the International Tribunal on Human Rights Violations Against Sexual Minorities, held in New York in 1995, Mariela told her story.
I bought
a house to raise the 17 children which I adopted and raised. The biological mothers had abandoned them or had given them to me so I could raise them. When I had to choose between my children and a man, I chose my children. When they became adults in 1881, I went to Chile to undergo surgery, since the sex change surgery is forbidden by law in Argentina. In Chile, the surgery is legal, and I obtained a legal ID with a woman's name. In Chile, I married an Argentinian man. Together, we went back to Argentina and adopted Mayra in 1990. I had met the biological mother who was pregnant and did not want children. I asked her not to have an abortion. She, in turn, asked me to take care of her baby after birth. Mayra's mother started to blackmail me. First, she demanded money, then a lot and a house. When I refused, she reported me to the police. The police came to my house and took away Mayra. I was arrested and taken to the police precinct. I was submitted to a long interrogation regarding my gender. Police officers of both genders forced me to show my genitals, as if I were an exotic animal in a zoo. The press exposed it in big headlines, calling me the transvestite mother. The Argentinian public was not fooled, however, and I received affection and empathy from everyone.
My case clearly proves that one can be a mother in the heart madre, and that biology has nothing to do with it.
Y que nada tiene que ver la biología.
My name is Lisa Gallardo, and here we are at the Plaza del Mercado in Santurce. Okay, as you can see, this is a place where they sell fruit and vegetables and everything, and this is where I come every single Saturday. I get breakfast, which is what I'm doing now. Getting a huge papaya drink, milk and cinnamon and everything, you know, all the good stuff, sweet stuff. Por favor, este miel, canela, leche, hielo. This is gonna be really good. I might even give you some. I love this place also. I come here to have lunch once in a while, some Saturdays, and they have the best fish here. Now, if you see a fish, really clear, crystal eyes, like, you know, taking a nice look at you, eat it. It's really fresh. And that's always what you get right here at La Coal. Every time I come here, have lunch, I think that, you know, that I'm gonna spend like 2 hours, and I always stay the whole afternoon. So many people coming here, so many fun people, different people. Okay, this is Cups. It's a lesbian bar here in town. It's one of our favorite spots in San Juan to come. They have live music on Saturdays, and when I mean live salsa, merengue music. It's been open since I remember. I mean, since I remember being a dyke, it's been open. And it's a great place to come. I don't know, I really like this place. I enjoy it. And if you come to Puerto Rico, this is one of the places you want to visit. From San Juan, Puerto Rico, this is Lisa Gallardo for Dyke TV. Ciao.
Yeah.
It's just great. I mean, you see lesbians in context around the world. And, of course, trans issues. You really are covering everything and getting contributions from everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, we were really committed to having as much a wide range of experiences and people represented in the show. And so we made a big effort. I mean, whenever, like I did the Lisa Gallardo piece, and I probably produced four or five pieces while I was in Puerto Rico. When I went to Brazil, I produced, you know, I probably produced five or six segments. We were always on the hunt for a lesbian story, no matter where we were, or what we were doing. And, so that was, yeah, that was a really important part of the show for us.
Oh, yes. And remember the women's conference in China?
Beijing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We sent people to China.
We had probably four or five producers that went. Yeah. And I think we produced like a dozen or more segments from that conference. And that's where we got a lot of our connections, actually, to follow up with people later once the conference was over, either as producers or to actually do stories about them. So, yeah, we were always looking for an international angle or, you know, not only international, but anywhere out in the U.S. as well. We really, really made an effort to have the various areas of the country represented.
And we solicited segments from people all over the country as well. And people started, after a little while, people started sending us material that was ready to go, basically.
Yeah.
And this was before the technology era that we have now that makes all of that so much easier.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. That's a whole other program about how
we distributed, I think, in the end, maybe the biggest amount was like 80 or 90 cities, and there had to be a tape dubbed and sent to each public access station. So it was much, much harder. And that was a big part of our budget was distribution.
Yes.
We had to get those tapes out there.
And now we're seen all over the world just by putting it on the internet. And we hear from viewers in all those places that you've covered. All right, we got one more chunk of material that I want to make sure to get in, and then we can chat a little more before we close this show.
Hello, I'm Pamela Sneed, and welcome to the arts. Cheryl Gagne is a powerful woman, is a friend of mine, but most importantly is a video maker. She has produced, directed, and edited a recent video called Janine. She's also in the Whitney Biennial. I think that's very impressive. The video is about a black lesbian and her relationship with a white upper middle class girl from high school. We also have a filmed interview with Cheryl. So I hope that you will, you know, check this out and pay special close attention, because this is Cheryl and I think you're going to like it.
My best friend in high school was Janine Sorelli. We met in the ninth grade. I had been going to Mary Mercy Academy for, you know, X number of years before she came into the picture. And it wasn't even really like a best friend. It was somebody that I really wanted to be friends with. And it took me a while to kind of get into her circle and her game. Funny thing is, we played basketball together, and that kind of got us into a friendship. And it was always like a constant struggle. We were never really on balance, at least in my mind.
I was always trying to be more like her in her world and get more into it. She was from the main line, wealthy, you know, mother had a business, drove a BMW, blah, 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 values, etc., while I was, you know, a black girl who lived with a working mother and lived in Philadelphia, as opposed to the other side of City Line Avenue. I lived on one side, which is the Philadelphia side. She lived on the other side, which was the Lower Merion, Bala Cynwyd side, which kind of meant something. Then it meant a lot to me, and I felt insignificant. I felt less of a person. I always wanted to be more of a person. I wanted to be more white, really. And, you know, Janine just really affected me a lot. She was blonde, blue eyes. She seemed so perfect, and I just seemed so imperfect. And just the class clown and the fool and just kind of goofy and out of place. And she, in one way, kind of made me feel like it, too. Or maybe I just made myself feel like it. I don't know, I never really kind of got over it. But in about the 10th grade or so, I kind of realized that I was gay, a lesbian. And I had feelings for her and stuff like that. And it never really came out. I remember once, maybe that year in the 10th grade, we were wrestling and she said something like, "Hey, why are we wrestling like this?" And I said, "I don't know," and just kind of played it off. But, you know, I also kind of remember, Janine giving me her used clothes, or like her old clothes that she didn't want, like old sweaters and stuff like that. Because she, I think she had this idea that I was like poor, black, struggling thing when, you know, I had good values and a good home too. You know, my mom, you know, worked and got me to the school and had been there much longer than she had been there. But I never really realized that then. I just began, you know, realizing it now. I mean, it took me a while to get to the stage of thinking about it. That's why I'm doing this piece.
Really, really poignant. And Cheryl Dunier, of course, is famous for making The Watermelon Woman.
Yes.
And has gone on. I was just looking up her IMDb listing. She is now directing episodes on network TV of The Rookie, Feds, The Equalizer, American Gigolo, The Umbrella Academy, Bridgerton, Claws, one of my all-time favorite series. She's gone on to a very mainstream career, as have many of the people who were involved with this or with other productions. It's astonishing.
Liz should speak about the arts, because the arts was our most consistent, just strong segment, and she produced that. And I can't even believe the people that we had on.
I know. You know what?
And our big deals now, Lisa Crone, Tony Award winning. Who's the painter that used to do the mural?
Nicole Eisenman.
She was at the very beginning of her career.
Just at the very beginning. You know what? Francesca Zambello, the big opera director, who just retired from being the director of Glimmerglass, she's still head of the Washington Opera. She came out on Dyke TV.
Wow.
Remember that? Oh, Harriet was on that shoot with us.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a whole story. I won't go into it now.
We don't have time. Part 2, 3, and 4 will be coming to a TV station near you in a minute. And I also I forgot to really point out Joan Nessel, who was talking about On Our Backs, who, of course, is the mother of the Lesbian History Archives and one of the great intellectuals of the lesbian community. I also do not want this show to end without thanking Anera Tiefenthaler, who put together all these. She's a video producer and editor, and Anera is just a genius at picking out this material and putting it together. And she has been just a hero in making this show possible. Also, all this material is at the Sophia Smith Collection. Am I saying that correctly? At Smith College. We're going to put up the Chyron with the information about that. And really one point I wanted to make about doing this show is that people should be out doing their own versions of things like this now. And we have, you know, we do Gay USA. We've been doing it to Andy and I for 27 years, but we don't, and we used to go out and shoot stuff, but we don't anymore. And we don't create this kind of material. And it sort of breaks my heart a little when I see this, because I so adore everything you were putting on the air. And I want people to go out there and produce stuff. And, you know, you can put it on public access channels. Those still exist. That's where we originate. Yes.
That's right.
I'm shocked. I'm actually shocked that nobody is doing it now. I know that that lesbian is, for some people, like, not a term they relate to. They relate more to queer. But I'm just given the technology, how much easier it is to produce video, to get it seen in viral situations. I really want someone to pick this up and start again, because there's so many stories out there that need to be heard. And I do feel like lesbians are a little bit of a dying breed, and I'm behind. No, I mean, I don't, maybe just in terms of the media though. And so I think we need to get a footprint out there again. I'm with you. And I'm putting out there that I would be willing to help anybody who's wants to resuscitate that, because I really think it should happen.
Yeah. Mary Paterno, we will hook you up. That's an amazing offer. And what I miss is the creativity, mm-hmm. the humor, the creativity, the fundamental talent that is so captured in these segments. And there's so much more. You know, this was a
12 years worth.
Yes.
And what killed Dyke TV in the end?
I think it was a lack of money, lack of resources. I really do think that was it. I mean, after a certain point, you know, everybody did everything for free for the most part. There was very few paid people. Yeah. We paid people who we couldn't get them to do stuff for free. You know what I mean? And the whole production end was all volunteer. So I think that was tough after a certain point. I mean, we had rent to pay in New York City. I mean, it was a struggle to make it happen. So I think that did it. And I think if the internet had been around, we wouldn't have had to spend as much money on, for instance, distribution and even getting producers outside of the city to produce for us.
Yeah, and I also think the mainstream did start picking up on lesbian themes. And the funding, we did have some funding. And I, again, looking through my old notes, we had a number of funders, but even women's organizations. Kathy Acey was a big supporter with the Astraea Foundation, for instance. She helped us so much. And we had a number of funders, but those also seemed to recede over a period of time, or they needed to spread their resources elsewhere.
All right. I have to cut this off because we're out of time, let alone resources. But to be continued, I am not finished with this conversation. But I so thank you both, Linda and Mary, for making this material available and for coming on to talk to us about it. The next 2 weeks on Gay USA will be Maren Johns and I doing news. And then Andy will be back after that. We are Gay USA. I hope you enjoyed this show, and we will see you next week.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.